Tomorrow, I want to look at two sides of leadership. Today, we'll be more focused on the negative traits, so three or four we're going to find in a passage of Scripture, and then tomorrow, we'll turn to the positive traits of leadership. I also realize that this is a wonderful time to train men and women for what is ahead, and you who will step into roles as servant leaders will surely face the experience, as all leaders do, of misinformation surrounding you. It will be often impossible for you to correct, and on other occasions, you will simply live out your life, and as David put it in the 26th Psalm, your integrity will defend you. Because misinformation surrounds significant people. We have sighed with individuals as we have come to the grocery checkout point at the store and glanced at the tabloid and seen famous names that appear, and we see the phony photos that have been put together by the tabloid publishers, and then stupid comments made. You know, this film star spoke with alien last night, or this woman gave birth to a three-headed snake, and you know, you think, good night, how does it even get into print? And the amazing thing is they sell out. That if there's dumb people that print it, there's dumber people that buy it and read it. The other day I was on a plane, and a woman brought on the plane to read the three tabloids that she could find. She spent her time just going through it. Oh, this is terrible. One of these days, it won't be on a tabloid, hopefully, but one of these days you'll be in print and there'll be misinformation, or somebody will introduce you and they'll do it wrong. I smiled when I read about the 20th anniversary of the American Football League that gathered back in 1979. Al Davis was there. Now the owner of the Oakland Raiders. And Davis told an interesting story about a friend of his named Nicky Hilton. He was sitting at the table with Nicky as he looked around the table and saw a number of people sort of envious of this man with a famous name and certainly a heavy pocketbook. And the envy only increased as the man who introduced him to speak that evening stood up and said, I am pleased to introduce the man who recently made $100,000 in Los Angeles in the baseball business, Nicky Hilton. And Hilton stood up and sort of with a wry smile said, I think I just need to correct all of that. It wasn't me. It was my brother, Baron. And it really wasn't Los Angeles. It was San Diego. And actually, it wasn't $100,000, it was $1 million. And he didn't make it. He lost it. So the whole thing was wrong. The whole thing was wrong. It's amazing how much misinformation swarms significant people. I think if the great Apostle Paul were to come back from beyond and appear in today's world, surely it wouldn't be long before somebody would get him on television. And certainly whoever introduced him would blow it. He would probably begin by saying, this is a man who spoke at a time when people really loved God. And he ministered in places where they just hung on his every word. He was an expert in church growth principles. He was a family man and often set forth great principles on parenting. And a popular writer and a dynamic speaker. And you're smiling with me because none of the above is true. As a matter of fact, people did not love God when Paul ministered. They never have. They never will. And folks did not hang on every word. His critics outnumbered his followers. And he was not a great proponent of today's church growth strategies. As a matter of fact, I think perhaps inadvertently, but I think he broke virtually every one of those principles as he founded churches across the Roman world. And he wasn't even married. He was no family man. And he wasn't beloved by his people, the Jews. They viewed him as a traitor, a turncoat. And when adopted, if you will, into the Gentile family of God, there were those who were suspicious of him. And in fact, I have my New Testament open to 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 10, where he quotes his critics as saying, his letters are weighty and strong, but his personal presence is unimpressive, and his speech contemptible. It doesn't sound very dynamic to you and me. Eugene Peterson, in his paraphrase of the Message, handles this verse: his letters are brawny and potent, but in person he's a weakling and mumbles when he talks. Mark it down, the popular opinion of the one who wrote these many letters in the New Testament was a misunderstood man. You and I admire him because of his character and his magnificent approach to life, his determination to press on in spite of circumstances that turned against him and people who deserted him and ugly remarks made about him, mistreatment. And you read the litany of those things in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, and if you're like me, you sigh. So we shouldn't be surprised when we look for leadership principles characterized by Paul that they're not like you would expect today. You comb today's management shelves in the secular bookstores and you realize it's another drumbeat, it's another cadence. It's almost as if the leader today needs to be some kind of mix between Mike Ditka and Lee Iacocca and Genghis Khan. Just kind of move in over people and take charge and get them out of the way if they're in your way and walk on them if necessary to get to the top of your ambition. Now, you know and I know that's not the way of Christ. That's not what he did. As a matter of fact, the only time I find that he is described in his makeup, he is described as meek and lowly in heart, inviting people to come, not demanding, not even requiring. So when I look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, for example, I come across some principles of leadership that are not popular and never will be. I don't think they were then. I know they're not now in our world. This is Paul's first letter. Some even say, in my study I found, some say it's the first letter of the New Testament, or the first writing of the New Testament, dated somewhere around AD 49, 50, early on. He has been in Thessalonica. He has traveled on to Berea and then Athens and finally comes to Corinth. Not much is recorded about either of those two places, certainly not much by way of results. Berea, They had a real love for, once he got to them and began to train them in the things of God, they had a hunger that was even greater than the Thessalonians. But Athens wasn't much, a few eggheads on the Areopagus, and a few people were interested, but most were not. I think he left depressed and discouraged and came into Corinth nearby, and shortly after coming, sat down to write his friends in Thessalonica, probably less than a year after having been there. And they remember his time with them. We see hints of that repeated in these first two chapters. For example, verse 5 of chapter 1, you know what kind of men we prove to be among you. You know that. You remember. Look down in chapter 2 and verse 1. You yourselves know, brothers, our coming to you was not a failure, was not in vain. Verse 2, after we had suffered and been mistreated in Philippi, as you know, another reminder that they remembered, they and he, along with his companions Timothy and Silas, had been with them. Verse 5, we never came with flattering speech. As you know, in verse 9, you recall. Verse 10, you are witnesses. Verse 11, as you know. So he's remembering and reminding them of how life was when he was one with them. I love when I come to verse 1 of chapter 2, his comment that it was not a failure. Every woman or man looking back on years of ministry in a former place longs to say those words, that it wasn't in vain. By the way, this is not the original word for unproductive or fruitless. This is a word that means hollow, without purpose, wanting in purpose. It wasn't like that. It wasn't an empty experience. I look back over three different places that I have served in different parts of the country. And in one of those three places, I feel like it was pretty futile. It was rather hollow. Those who were there are kind in their remembering. People have selective memories, and they choose to be kind to me when I visit with them. But I recall without a great deal of delight one of those three places where I served as a pastor. I also can look back and say on occasion that this was not in vain. It's a wonderful thing. I look back on my years in seminary and say, well, it was not in vain. It was transforming the lives that touched my life. And I like it also that he is vulnerable enough to admit that he came not as a knight in shining armor, but as a wounded animal. He says, remember, I just came from Philippi when I got to you. Verse 2, we had suffered and been mistreated. This is a significant word. Suffering, shamefully treated is the idea. I don't know if you've checked Acts 16 lately, but if I read it correctly, he was stripped naked in the streets, flogged, and shoved in jail to die. It was there he and Silas sang at midnight, and there was an earthquake, and the result was his being, you know, sprung from a prison. But he came to Thessalonica with the scabs out of Philippi, suffering, having been mistreated. Even when he was at Thessalonica, he presented the gospel amid much opposition. And you can read of that also in Acts 16. We don't know the half of it. Just a little section of Acts covering a month or so he spent there, maybe as long as 2 months. This is a great moment for me to add another introductory comment about ministry. We're all from wombs of woe. Every person you admire has scabs and scars. And they may not tell you about them, but that is what has given them the seasoned wisdom that you admire. The word today is dysfunction. Many of you come from that. Don't be ashamed of that. That's part of your making. Some of you have been shamefully mistreated, weren't loved as you wish you had been loved. It doesn't disqualify you. That helps if you work through that kind of thing, and part of that has to do with seminary life. You work through those insecurities and struggles and scabs and wounds. You emerge a better minister of the gospel. I mean, who wants to listen to one who's never known heartache, suffering, or disappointment, or failure? I like Churchill's comments. Success? It's going from one failure to the next without loss of enthusiasm. That's a new thought, isn't it? These men and women that sit on this platform have known failure, and they will know it again. For all you know, they're struggling with a time of barrenness in their own life, as some of you are. And it's amid much opposition you're going through your days in seminary. The ones we're praying for these days are not the only ones hurting. I think some of you, if the truth were known, could stand and wave your hand and say, pray for me. I'm not hospitalized, and my wife doesn't have lymphoma, but I tell you, these are the toughest days of our lives, just keeping our stuff together. I remember my senior year, just coming into my senior year, the tough things that hit us, and I thought it was supposed to get easier. And I pulled up close to one of our profs who's still on the faculty, and he reminded me, where'd you read it's going to get easier? I thought, boy, that's encouraging. I got that in front of me. And you know what? Getting out, it even got tougher for Cynthia and me in other very personal areas. It's amid much opposition that the leader emerges. Do not resent them as enemies, but understand they're friends, these things crowding into your life. Now, with that as kind of a background, he mentions to begin with what I consider to be four traits that nobody appreciates in a leader. And he begins by saying they were not the things that marked his life, regardless of what his critics were saying. First of all, he wasn't a deceptive leader. His life wasn't marked by deception. He says, our exhortation does not come from error or impurity or by way of deceit. We didn't play tricks on you. That month or month and a half, 2 months we were there, you can't look back and name one time that I manipulated you or took advantage of you. Well, it wasn't by way of deception. It wasn't double-tongued. It wasn't hypocritical. I didn't have a hidden agenda. I didn't have something sexual going on the side in a secret part of my life that nobody knew about. You had to find out with your disappointment a year later that really was what was going on. I didn't live a double life. It wasn't by way of error or impurity or deceit. The late Dwight Eisenhower once wrote, "In order to be a leader, one must have followers, and to have followers, one must have their confidence. Hence, the supreme quality for a leader is unquestionably integrity. Without it, no real success is possible. No matter whether it is a section gang, a football field, in an army, or in an office. When your staff discovers that you are a deceptive leader, it is virtually impossible to restore their respect. So get it real straight during your years in seminary that deception is not a part of leadership. When you are wrong, say it. When you realize your counsel was unwise, admit it. When you don't know it, confess you don't know. There's integrity in saying it with that kind of plain speech. John Stott writes, "Happy are those Christian leaders today who hate hypocrisy and love integrity, who have nothing to conceal or be ashamed of, who are well known for who and what they are, and who are able to appeal without fear to God and the public as their witnesses. We need more transparency and openness of this kind today." To that I say a rousing amen. A negative characteristic of a leader is deception. Stay away from it. There's a second. The next verse. Verse 4. Just as we have been approved by God, dokimazo. That's a great word, tested for the purpose of approval. We have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. So we speak, and another negative, not as pleasing people, but God, who examines our heart. The true leader is one who is not a flattering people pleaser. Now, that doesn't mean you major in being abrasive. That is not the alternative. It means you major in pleasing God. Which means occasionally there will be those who really did respect you and speak highly of you and spoke highly of you, but when you followed God's leading, they resented it. You don't pander to people who stand against your walk with God. Paul says, I didn't come with flattery. I didn't tell you what you wanted to hear. I told you what you needed to hear. The older you get and a little crustier you get, the less you will care what they think. And the more you will care what he thinks. What do you want, O God? Where do you want me to serve you? How do you want me to deliver this? What is it you wish me to say? Guide me, O thou great Jehovah, in this pilgrim land. The apostle says, I didn't sit on the fence and remain neutral so that I could please both sides. My good friend Clyde Cook, is president of Biola University, has a few little signs on his desk. And one of my favorites is a little sign that reads, I don't have the secret of success, but I do know the secret of failure. Try to please everybody. It's a killer. And you will lose the respect of those with integrity when they see you people-pleasing and backslapping in empty flattery. Paul says, I didn't do that. You remember that wasn't my style. There's a third, simply greed. Verse 5. We never came with flattering speech, as you know, nor, here's the third negative, nor with a pretext for greed. Greed is the desire to get more, to possess more than one needs or one ought to have. We usually apply this to money, don't we? First thought is greed for more money, which is a plague in itself. But it can apply to other things. You can have a greed of attendance so that your church gets larger than the one down the street. God deliver us from that. Since when do numbers mean success? If they do, the cults are winning. God always works through a minority, always has a remnant that's faithful. And a pretext for greed for results, bigger buildings, more attractive looking stuff. Or we have more truth than they have. There's a whole lot of pride woven into the fabric of that greed. Just teach the truth. Don't tell everybody you've got more of it. Just teach it. They'll spot it. Sheep aren't that dumb. They come where there's good food. Greed can cut your legs out from under you, especially if you're given to comparison and envy. Probably there's no more subtle temptation in ministry than envy, jealousy. That's why pastors' conferences are always tough. You're either depressed because you're a little guy and you don't have a big record, you know, you can fall back, or you're proud because you were 1,500 last year, and you're now pushing 2,000 this year. Who cares? Who cares? Let another man praise you and not your own mouth, a stranger and not your own lips. Leave it alone. Someone has said greed has three facets, love of things, love of fame, love of pleasure. And these can be attacked directly with frugality, anonymity, and moderation. Watch out for greed. Some of you will become, in the world's eyes, wonderfully successful. You'll have a name. You'll be known in the community. For all you know, you'll be known all over the city or even in the state, and certainly among the Christian community. And you're the ones I worry about the most. Just hold it loosely. Remember that? Just hold it loosely. Leaders are not authoritarianistic. That's the fourth. That's verse 6. Nor, here's another negative. You've seen them. Verse 3, does not. Verse 4, not. Verse 5, never. Nor, verse 6, nor. It's just right there in the text. Nor did we seek glory from men. It's the word glory hog that I think of here. I wasn't a glory hog. Furthermore, I didn't push my weight around. See how he puts it? I didn't seek glory from you, either you or others, even though as apostles of Christ, we might have asserted our authority. And by the way, they will let you. When you make a name, they'll let you take advantage of them. How do you think these folks that got caught doing it got away with it? They let them. There was no one saying the hard thing, holding them accountable. There was no staff that pulled up close and said, you know, I'd notice an erosion in your style over the last 6 to 8, 10 months. You're talking a whole lot more about you and a lot less about the Savior. It bothers me. Always have some folks around you who'll talk truth. Ideally in private and in love, but truth. Because you'll have a whole lot of people who will let you assert your authority. Paul says, I didn't do that. I wasn't authoritarianistic. I wasn't an autocratic ruler. Even though as an apostle of Christ, I really had authority. Elton Trueblood, way back in 1952, wrote a book called Your Other Vocation. And in it, he says, it is hard to think of any job in which the moral element is lacking. The skill of the dentist is wholly irrelevant if he is unprincipled and irresponsible. There is little in that case to keep him from withdrawing teeth unnecessarily, because the patient is usually in a helpless situation. It's easy to see the harm that can be done by an unprincipled lawyer. Indeed, such a person is far more dangerous if he is skilled than if he is unskilled. You're becoming skilled at this place. That's part of our goal, is to help you be skilled in the Scriptures. And there aren't enough of those kind of folks around, so you'll be altogether unique in the community, quite possibly. And you'll become an expositor of the Scriptures. You'll be able to work your way through the passage, and I'll tell you, you'll be amazed at times how God uses that. It's His Word, remember. He says He'll bless it. You're just a mouthpiece. And then you'll gain in stature. And before you know it, you'll start expecting perks and kid glove treatment and special care. Remember 1 Thessalonians 2:6. We didn't seek glory, and we didn't throw our weight around or come across as important. Well, did you get them? Little review. Deception and hypocrisy, let's have none of that. People-pleasing flattery, check that one off. Greed, stay away from it. I deliberately stayed away from the money thing because I think we hammer away at that enough. But obviously money is a part of it. Never do something because there's money in it, or move on because there's more money there. It's kind of a neat thing to talk with a group of people and never bring it up. I know that's old-fashioned. I know. It's not the way we do it now. Do I care how it's done now? I care about what's right. I just know my heart's greedy. And suddenly when they wave a big salary in front of me, it's amazing how God's clearly directing in this mess. It's kind of nice to have that discussed last. Yes, it ought to be discussed. But push it to the end. You're not in it for yourself anyway. And number four is authoritarianism. As God's representative, you can be certain misinformation will spread about you. Just make sure it's not the truth. You can't keep it from spreading. Bombs will go off and they'll explode here and there. And just rest securely in the fact that they're not true. I'm reading, and I'm through with this quote. I'm reading Churchill on Leadership. That's a great book. It's called, the subtitle is better than the title, Executive Success in the Face of Adversity. What a crusty old guy Churchill was. I like the guy. He took two naps a day. He bathed twice a day. Man, that's a clean guy that'll bathe twice a day. He dictated to his secretary when he was in the bathtub. Now, don't take that too far, okay? That's just, she's probably sitting way away and he yelled, you know, what he was saying and all that. But he was a funny guy. Listen to this. I told you not to go there, and some of you are going over there. Churchill was no stranger to the number one problem faced by all executives, stress. Churchill's colleagues and friends marveled at how calm he was amid the most trying circumstances. In part, his ability to deal with stress and trial was a function of his courage and fearlessness. He would, for example, set up his painting easel near the front line trenches in World War I. That is not a guy you want to fight next to, by the way. But he would set up his painting easel and paint away as shells exploded nearby. He would seldom duck when the shells exploded, sensibly observing that by the time you hear the report of an exploding shell, it's too late to duck. I love that line. Guy's a Calvinist. It was this innate courage that enabled him to gather strength in a crisis. Innate courage. I'm going to tell you, there is nothing that will give you courage like walking in truth. Walking authentically as a woman or man of God. They cannot take that away. Just print whatever they want. The folks who know you well will tear that paper up saying, that's not the person I know. That's not the truth. Lord, these are such important things. Not to me. They are important to you. And so as we have sung, we ask you to guide us as the great Jehovah. We're mere pilgrims. Things explode around us all the time. It's easy to get a little punchy and to run scared and to operate from weakness rather than from God-given, Christ-inspired confidence that comes from the truth of the book. That is the inerrant word of the living God. Bring us to it, our Father, in all of our woundedness and need and struggles. In spite of our own insecurities and fears, we come to find within its lines the direction and guidance and courage that we haven't in ourselves. Use these messages to help make that happen. For Jesus' sake, amen.